all. The first case for argument this morning is Harper v. Albert. Mr. Mills?
Thank you, Your Honor. This case brings before the court two issues which I think intersect here perfectly, both developing issues regarding the Eighth Amendment and its application to excessive use of force cases. Both of my clients began the day in question in their cells at Menard Correctional Center. Neither of them had any injuries. After their interactions with the tactical unit, which includes all of the defendants here, Mr. Padilla was in the hospital, his jaw swollen out to the size of a grapefruit, and needed multiple stitches to close the wounds on his head. What has never been disputed in this case is that they didn't do anything to deserve any punishment at the hands of these defendants. Each of the defendants filled out contemporaneous incident reports. None of them mentioned any sort of a struggle, any sort of resistance, any attempts to get away, anything that would have justified the sorts of injuries that were inflicted. It's our contention, therefore, that this is a case which, in which the joint liability of all the defendants is clear. They clearly used force to inflict punishment, something that the Supreme Court, as recently as last term in the Hope case, has said is never justified. Yet, all of them were found not guilty, or the verdict entered against them, by the jury in this case. Our contention is that the reason is because the district court, primarily on the motion for directed verdict at the end of our case, gutted our case and left the jury with very little choice but to define in the defendant's favor. First of all, the district court judge held as a matter of law that much of the punishment that was inflicted did not rise to the level of an Eighth Amendment claim, despite the fact that there was no evidence of any sort of resistance by the defendants. I think that argument has been put to rest by the Hope case. In the Hope case, the hitching post case, the injuries were relatively minor. Sore arms, sunburn, nothing that hospitalized anyone, nothing that required any stitches. Yet the Supreme Court found that the injuries in that case obviously violated the Eighth Amendment. Again, because there was no justifiable reason for them. In Hope, they created a sliding scale, essentially saying that when there is no justification used for force at all, then any use of force that causes any injury to a prisoner is not acceptable under the Eighth Amendment.
Were the defendant and Mr. Mills any more identifiable in Hope than in our case here?
It depends on which opinion you read. Certainly, the majority opinion suggests that they were not. There were a lot of individual officers who took various actions. It wasn't at all clear from the majority opinion which of those officers it was who actually made the final decision to hook him up to the hitching post. That was an issue that was raised by the dissent, saying it has to be individual liability, but again, the majority clearly disagreed with Justice Thomas, just as I think they should have done here. In this case, it's a case that cries out for joint liability against all of the defendants together. They were all there. We know who was there. The Department of Corrections performed its own internal investigation, which identified what each of the defendants did in terms of where they were during this process, who was holding who was walking next to who. All of these defendants were present during the time that the injuries were inflicted. All of them either had their hands on one of the two plaintiffs, or they stood next to the two plaintiffs and watched whatever went on.
Is that the same offense? Is it cruel and unusual punishment to, obviously if they're beating up on them and doing that sort of thing, that's a violation, but for those who stand by and in effect either acquiesce or do whatever, is that a separate offense or the same offense?
Well, they're both violations of the Eighth Amendment. The courts have sometimes categorized one as a failure to protect case, that is the people standing next to them fail to protect them, and if they had a reasonable opportunity to intervene, then they are just as liable as are the people who struck the blows themselves. That's what this court held in Miller, and the Supreme Court had held in numerous occasions, including Hudson itself, one of the first cases, where a sergeant who stood by and sort of egged on the offenders was held just as liable as the ones who actually struck the blows.
Well, is it the same offense or is it a different offense? It seems that the district court thought it was you had to prove that either they stood by or they participated, but to just say it's a joint and several liability, you couldn't do that.
think that in order to be jointly and separately liable, both of them have to have done, all of them have to have done something wrong. I don't think they have to have done the same thing wrong, however, and that's clearly what this court was suggesting in the Miller case. In the Miller case, I think, is exactly on point here. That's the one where a motorist was pulled over by several police officers, ended up face down on the concrete, being hit. He didn't know which of the officers it were who landed the blows, and this court decided, and the district court dismissed, or entered summary judgment, because he couldn't identify which of the individual officers struck which blows. This court said, you can't do that. On an Eighth Amendment case, either they were right there inflicting the blows, or they were standing next door, that makes all of them liable. You can't throw it out because the man who's on the ground and can't figure out which officer is hitting him can't identify which officer struck which blow. That's particularly clear in this case. There's just no way. I mean, these guys, the defendants, took it upon themselves, in a sense, to disguise themselves. That is, they were all wearing identical uniforms, identical riot helmets, which
you
made
said
identification.
That they took it upon themselves?
Yes.
Don't they always wear that?
Not all correctional officers wear that.
Don't the officers in that squad?
Yes.
Well, then they didn't take it upon themselves. They're doing it under their orders to do it.
Okay, perhaps
I mean,
should
that's,
say...
that's a exaggeration on your part.
They may have been following orders, but I suppose so was the officer.
But they didn't do it to disguise themselves.
Well, I think they did do it to disguise themselves, whether it was intentional on their part and they made it up on their own,
if
or whether
they into a situation, don't they usually get dressed for with riot gear?
Yes, they do, but they also intentionally don't put name tags on that riot gear. Unlike every other officer in the institution who wears a name tag so that they can be readily identified, the officers on the riot squad do not. That makes it extremely difficult to identify them, particularly since they're all dressed the same, particularly since these are officers who are not on the usual units, and therefore a general prisoner wouldn't know who they were by face.
Is it your theory that an officer who is just observing is equally responsible for those who you allege are participating?
If he was observing in a situation where he had a reasonable opportunity to intervene and stop that, then yes, he's just as guilty as the others are.
Okay.
That, I think, is exactly the holding that this court made in Miller, that an officer has a duty to intervene in that situation. He's not a citizen. He's a law enforcement officer. His
was
job is to
Mr. Padilla resisting?
Were they resisting?
Yes.
No.
Mr. Padilla agreed when they said that they wanted to search him. He said, go ahead.
Initially, when they asked him to come out of the cell, they said no. But once the tactical unit arrived, they voluntarily walked out of the cell.
We're talking about at the time of the search.
Oh, yes.
Strip search.
Yes. There was no resistance at all.
Padilla cooperated all the way through.
Yes. After he left the cell, he cooperated all the way through.
Put his arms up and everything else.
Well, I don't think he was given that
clothes off so they could strip search him.
Well, his testimony was he wasn't given that opportunity. He was taken to the floor and it was ripped off. And then he was beaten. So he didn't have the opportunity. It's not like they said, would you put out your hands? And he said no. Instead, they just walked into the room and threw him on the floor and stripped his clothes off. He never had an opportunity, but he didn't resist.
And the jury didn't believe that, is that right?
Well, I don't know if the jury believed it, because I don't think the jury was properly instructed to put that squarely before them.
Okay.
As to the special verdict, Mr. Mills, you challenge it, as I understand, because it doesn't cover all the defendants?
I think that it was unclear what it meant. Unfortunately, it was apparently put in there at the last minute. There's no discussion anywhere in the record as to what the purpose of that was. It was clearly not an instruction that either side asked for. It was a district court's instruction, and nothing in the transcript suggests that it was discussed by the parties at all.
Well, assuming that it could be submitted.
No, I'm not suggesting it's improper.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that you are either. As to the defendant's names, doesn't the finding preclude an excessive force finding during the relevant period?
Well, I don't think that it does. I think that you have to review the special interrogatory in light of all the rest of the instructions that were given, which clearly told the jurors what particular actions they were supposed to consider by which particular defendants, and excluded, for example, pounding Mr. Padilla's head against the bars as he was first being taken out. When he testified, somebody grabbed his tail and pounded his head against it. That was explicitly excluded from the jury's consideration by all of the instructions. I don't think that you can ask the jury without any explanation to have ignored all of the other 10 minutes of instructions they were given before and then say for that one last instruction, oh, well, gee, we were supposed to ignore all the rest of that and then consider it as if we had not heard the rest of them. I think that those, that special interrogatory has to be read in light of all the rest of the instructions, which specifically limited who they could deal with and what particular actions they could deal with. At this point, my light is on, so I will reserve the rest of it.
Yeah. It's your time. I mean, you want to use it now?
I'd rather reserve it for my rebuttal.
Understood.
Thank you,
Mr. Mills. Ms. Welch.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, the Department of Corrections employees. So the first thing that the court needs to remember is that there was a jury verdict here. There was a jury verdict in particular in favor of Lieutenant Albert, and the charge against him was that he used excessive force or knew and consented to the use of excessive force against Mr. Harper all the way through the strip search and against Mr. Padilla from cell to cell. Now, if the jury found that Lieutenant Albert, who was there throughout all the events, did not know and consent to the use of excessive force that, by other people, that means that the jury found that no one used excessive force. And if there were any doubt about this, the special interrogatories, as Judge Strong indicated, supports this. The wording of the special interrogatory is very broad. It doesn't say the other defendants. It doesn't say the defendants before you now. It says no prison employee. And that means, you know, did any prison employee use excessive force? No. It couldn't be broader than that. The jury, there was no limiting aspect to this instruction. So what the jury told us with its answers to these two special interrogatories is that no prison employee used excessive force against Mr. Harper through the strip search and against Mr. Padilla from cell to cell. This would include the incident about the head and, you know, Mr. Padilla's allegation that, or testimony that his head was pulled against the bars and so on. This would include every moment of the incident except Mr. Harper's going to his cell. And it's important to note that the special interrogatories really track the allegations against Lieutenant Albert. Because Lieutenant Albert, the only time Lieutenant Albert wasn't present was when Mr. Harper was taken to his final destination. Otherwise, he says he was there for every single event. So this tells us that no excessive force was used. Obviously, force was used, but no excessive force was used. And that's what the Eighth Amendment is about. Was the force disproportionate to the need? The jury said no. The force was what was needed. Now, the problem here, as we see it, is that the plaintiffs are confusing allocation of damages theories like joint and several liability or market share liability, which you use once you have proven tortfeasors, against causation theory, and confuses them with causation theories. Now, causation theories, this is what Hessel, what this court said in Hessel, you don't have collective liability, you don't have collective punishment just because someone is there when another person commits a tort. Now, it's true, as counsel suggested and as the court has held, that there are two ways that you can be liable under the excessive force component of the Eighth Amendment. One is if you're the person who uses the excessive force, and the other is if you fail to protect. Now, the problem here is the plaintiff, throughout the course of the litigation, has proceeded on a single theory. Every single one of the defendants used excessive force. Every single one. And in addition, Lieutenant Albert knew about it and consented to it and directed the team to do so. And Lieutenant Stanley, Captain Stanley, told Albert to tell the team to do this. Now, if you look at the complaint, if you look at the pretrial memorandum, if you read, as I did just yesterday again, the statement, there's nothing about failure to protect in there. There's nothing about these other guys stood aside. Either each defendant hit them or stood by and watched. Plaintiff's theory has been from the get-go, each of these guys used force.
Well, Ms. Walsh, would you say it's in reading Miller, our Miller case,
mm-hmm.
If you have a fact scenario where you claim several attack you,
mm-hmm.
You can't specify observer versus direct participant in the sense of striking of blows, would you say that you should be held to a initially a statement that says that everyone committed the excessive force? I mean, I isn't it a catch-22 to say six individuals attacked me? I don't know which of those struck the blows. I can't identify observers, but say two observers versus four direct participants. At what point would you say that theory has to change to reflect that two-thirds did the striking and one-third did not?
Well, I think as soon as you don't know, and the plaintiff has always admitted all along that he didn't know which particular one did which, I think you have to bring both theories in order to find every single person liable. Because not everyone, obviously, was a direct participant.
So you're saying it's not subsumed in a claim that everyone committed the Eighth Amendment violation or the alleged Eighth Amendment violation. At some point, you've got to say that some were direct and some were indirect, if you will.
Right, in my opinion, you could say this particular one either hit me or watched the other people. This one either hit me or watched the other people. I mean, and that would be a reasonable thing, and I think that's what Miller stands for. And I think that the plaintiff there had brought both theories. But the problem here is, as the plaintiff candidly admitted in his reply brief, he decided not to bring a failure to protect theory. This was a strategy decision, and, you know, unfortunately it backfired. What happened here was that, as I read the record, is that there was an in-concert liability theory. But the problem with that is that there's no evidence that there was a meeting of the minds, which is what you need for in-concert liability. There's no evidence, for example, that any of the, in the case in chief, the only evidence for most of the defendants was the investigation report. So there's no evidence that they knew beforehand what was going on, that they had known about the hot water being thrown, that they had any idea what the precursor was to the cell extraction, just that two guys needed to be extracted from the cell and were not doing so voluntarily. Not only does the in-concert liability theory not work here because of the lack of evidence, but also the alternative liability theory doesn't work here because there you have, that's the two guys, you know, shoot their guns negligently. One of them obviously hits, we can't tell which one, and then the burden shifts. I mean, again, just like with the allocation of liability theories, first you have to prove the defendant did what you say they did, what you're alleging they did. And only after that do you get to the second stage of allocation of responsibility, allocation of damages, or burden shifting of liability to disprove that you were one of the people involved.
So you say that this is if they had made the allegations that of the 11, some engaged in the physical attack and others stood by when they should have intervened.
Right.
If they had made those allegations at the outset, that would have been enough to take it to the jury to either allocate or at least go to the proof of who did what?
Yes, John, I think so, because that's why Lieutenant Albert, for example, went forward, because the case against him was that he knew and consented, which is similar.
We were able to identify him specifically. We weren't able to identify anyone else specifically. Is that the problem?
Correct. I mean, that was one problem. But the concept is there is that Lieutenant Albert, as an identified person and also as the supervisor, known as supervisory liability theory, that he was the one who knew and consented, which is similar to a failure to protect claim. And again, the jury here found, you know, the plaintiffs can't escape this. The jury here found that the force that was used was not excessive under the circumstances. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's why they decided that Lieutenant Albert was not guilty of anything. Because the force used in this case was simply not excessive under the circumstances. It really was a credibility contest. The plaintiff said, we didn't do anything and we got beaten up. And the, you know, and the defendants, once they got to trial, said, well, there was some resistance. I differ with counsel. It was disputed whether the plaintiffs did anything to warrant the use of force against them. There was, they said that there were, at first they refused to cooperate, but then they did. When they were coming down from the one cell house to the other cell house, that they were resisting, and then, you know, the guards tightened up their grip and so on. And when they got to the strip search, there was testimony that both of the defendants resisted and resisted violently. They kicked, they thrashed out, and so on. And that was when the force was used. To the extent, and that's probably when the injuries were inflicted. But again, the jury here, the plaintiffs just cannot get away from the fact that the jury here found that there was, that the force used was not excessive. There are two other theories that the plaintiff has for a new trial. One is about the evidence of indemnification. That was only Mr. Smithson, who testified about that. He didn't go to trial, and there was nothing in his testimony that had anything to do with a financial burden. So certainly we didn't open the door to evidence of indemnification. And then the other question is the jury instruction 18A. 18A was about the scope of liability, and plaintiff, there's nothing in the record to show that plaintiff's objection was that it should have included a and standing by component. The only objection on the record that plaintiff made was that it did not include the pulling of Mr. Padilla's ponytail against the bars. So if there are no further questions, the jury here found that that the plaintiff's story was simply not believable, that the force used against them was not excessive, and that finding precludes a reversal of the Rule 50 motion, because obviously if the jury found, after hearing all the evidence, that there was no reason to find any of the defendants, particularly Lieutenant Albert or any prison employee, had used excessive force, then that means that the Rule 50 motion was properly granted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Welch. Mr. Mills?
First of all, it's important to remember that we're on a Rule 50. Most of the defendants here were put out on a Rule 50, not after the jury verdict. As counsel admitted, obviously force was used. The contemporaneous documents prepared by the defendants indicate there were no injuries, no resistance, no reason to use any force except for, as she said at the end, having to tighten their grip as they were walking down the path to the segregation unit. This is not a Hetzel case. Hetzel is the case where people were searching, the police were searching a house, one of them allegedly stole a can of Coke during this search. What the court said is that's not a proper case for joint and several liability. Only one of the officers stole a can of Coke. The others, there was no evidence that they knew about it, that they could have done anything about it, that they did anything wrong whatsoever. In this case, we know each of them was there and each of them directly participated. I think that the line that counsel is trying to draw between this direct and indirect participation is an impossible line to draw in this case. For example, the district court, in ruling on the Rule 50 motion, talked about the distinction between a man who might have thrown a punch at one or either of the two plaintiffs and the men who were holding them, still with their jacked up behind with their face down to the concrete. He said, well, the people who were holding them couldn't be liable because they had no way of knowing that the punch was coming, and we couldn't identify who threw the punch, therefore nobody could be held liable for that. He seemed to be trying to draw a distinction between the people who were holding them just to be able to protect, and the people who actually threw the punch were the direct Eighth Amendment violators. I think that the person who holds someone still so that somebody else can punch them is just as liable as the one that throws the punch.
But that wasn't the case in Miller, was it?
I'm sorry?
That wasn't the case in Miller, was it?
No, Miller was not that. Miller was only standing by. Miller's, in that case, in that sense, ours is a stronger case than Miller. In our case, everybody had their hands on people. Everybody
in Miller,
was there.
There were allegations of both.
Yes.
And in this case, there are only allegations of the activity. We don't have the standing by allegation, which seemed to trouble the district court.
Well, it may not have been in the complaint explicitly, but there was certainly a claim in the complaint that all of them used excessive force, as counsel has said. Both of these fall under the rubric of excessive force, both the failure to protect and the actual delivering of blows. fall under the rubric of excessive force under notice pleading, it's certainly enough that was in the complaint.
Well, what was in your pretrial?
The same general rubric, but it's clear that it's a Rule 50 motion argument. We talked about both, and that we cite the transcript is attached to our brief as at appendix page 16. We very explicitly say both parts during that argument. There was no confusion in the court's mind as to what our argument was.
Well, the court seemed to be trying to sort that out, and I don't know, were you the trial attorney?
Yes, I was.
Saying you're kind of insisting that this is everybody, joint and several. He looked like he was trying to get you to divide it, or at least to give you that opportunity, and you chose not to.
Well, that's right, because I do think that the person who holds the man is just as liable as the person who hits him, and that's the distinction he was trying to get me to draw, to say that the guy is
not like Miller, where someone was clearly standing by.
Well, we don't know what happened.
Well, that's the trouble, isn't it?
I think that was the trouble in Miller, too. Again, they didn't know in Miller whether or not all of them were punching, or whether some were standing by and others were punching. The court said it doesn't matter. All of them were doing one or the other, and therefore you don't have to identify who was doing what or say one was standing by. So all we know, all three of them were there kicking the guy. We don't know, and he didn't know because he was lying face down. Same is true here. Maybe all 15 defendants did land blows. My guys don't know. During a large part of this time, they were face down, and all they could see was their own shoes or the concrete below them. They couldn't see who was landing blows. For all we know, all of them did. That's why I refused to say during the pretrial conference or anywhere else, defendant X is only responsible for failure to protect, and defendant Y is the one who landed the blows. We didn't know that. What we do know is all of them were there, all of them participated, and the jury should have been allowed to sort out all the defendants, not knock out the vast majority of them on the Rule 50 motion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. The case will be taken under advisement. The court